Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is composer Stephen Stuckey. In 2005, Stuckey was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Music for his second concerto for orchestra. Stuckey's relationship with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, for which he was appointed in 1988, is the longest running between a composer and an orchestra in the country. Since 1980, Stuckey has been a Given Foundation professor of composition at Cornell University. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Good evening.
Now, let's talk about this. You didn't come from a musical family, so where did you find your inspiration to become a musical person?
It's not so clear. I must have had a sort of mutant gene that, you know, my parents, neither my parents nor I understood, but it somehow drove me. They tell the story that when I was a little boy, instead of going out to play with the other kids, I would listen to records all day, and with my ear physically pressed up against the speaker, I guess to get maximum, you know, sensation. They took me to be tested by some doctors to see what was wrong with me. and in fact, they never found out, as far as I can tell. But I did have a grandfather who was a violinist, and I had sort of forgotten about this connection because he died when I was young. But I recovered this past summer a beautiful photograph of him taken in 1915, wearing tails, holding his violin, and I think he was a violinist in a sort of theater orchestra in the Midwest. And so that's inspired me now. I look at that picture now and then.
So it must have come from there. But your parents must have given you classical music. And what kind of records were you
listening
to?
Well, my mother had a collection of two records. They were the New World Symphony of Dvorak and Peter and the Wolf. And I played them over and over again. I must have destroyed them, you know, in the process.
Wow, that's an amazing beginning. So when did you actually decide that you were going to be a composer?
Well, I began trying to be a composer before I could read music and before I could play an instrument. I just had this idea that this thing which excited me so much, I wanted to make it myself. I wanted to make some myself. I remember when I was in grade school, and in those days you had pretty good music education in the public schools, and we were studying composers. I remember specifically Wagner for some reason. Now imagine an 8 or 10 year old kid trying to make sense of Wagner anyway. But
so dramatic. Maybe that's what attracted you.
And we had to make a sort of, as a school project, a sort of notebook of great composers. And I left a blank page with a sort of square where my head was going to go, you know, and my bio.
So were you actually hearing sounds in your head and not able at that time with the right tools to write it down?
You know, I don't remember. Probably not really. I do remember that when I finally started composing seriously, that is, you know, understanding music notation and playing an instrument and having a teacher and so on, I was mostly recycling the music that I'd heard already. That's the way people start generally. So what I was hearing in my head was by other people.
Wow. Now, was there ever a question in your mind at this point that you were going to have music part of your life forever?
You know, I never had a plan B. And I've been very lucky I didn't have to fall back on plan B because I didn't have one. It must have scared the heck out of my parents, looking back, you know, that I was probably doomed in their view. But somehow I've been lucky.
So you found teachers in public schools who encouraged you.
Very encouraging teachers in public schools. And I must say, my parents also, when I insisted, found me a private composition teacher when I was probably an early teenager in the little town of, not little, medium-sized city of Abilene, Texas. It's probably smaller now than it was then. And this was a guy who wrote all kinds of things. He was an organist, and he wrote musicals. I remember one about Tulsa, you know, an oil man and so on. I can still sing a couple of the tunes.
I'm not going to ask you to do that, though.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Now, your parents, you said, thought you were rather weird. Did you feel like an isolated kid having this incredible vision in your head about music?
You know, you do feel a little isolated. It's not a normal thing, and it probably was socially crippling at school occasionally, you know. I was thinking about this the other day because I'm currently in Los Angeles running a program for high school composers through the orchestra. We've sort of adopted a handful of composers that we found through a competition in the schools. And thinking, these guys must feel like geeks and nerds, and we need to band together, and they need to know that someone cares about them. And I'm giving them lessons and classes, and they're meeting with philharmonic musicians, and suddenly they belong.
But you were brought up in the turbulent 60s. Were you ever attracted to popular music?
You know, it's funny that I was surrounded by popular music, but I never somehow gravitated towards it. I was growing up mainly in the Midwest and the Southwest, so I was more likely to hear country and Western music in my, you know, social class than rock and roll, actually. I think I was the last kid in my school to figure out the Beatles, although I finally did.
It was probably forced on you. Now, are there rituals that you follow when you set out to compose a piece?
Well, there's an ideal way to set out to compose a piece, and then there's reality. And the ideal way for me would be to have a pretty clear vision of the piece ahead of time, a kind of roadmap, an idea of how long the piece should be, what its personality should be, its, you know, moods, its characters, even maybe the shape of the piece, a sort of, you know, so that I would have some large blanks to fill in. And maybe also some tunes or chords or, you know, materials. Very often what happens instead is that when a piece is approaching, and very often it's approaching because of a commission, somebody's asked for a piece, I've signed a contract, I may have cashed a check already, you know, and then suddenly there's a kind of legal pressure. And then when the piece is approaching, I sort of get stage fright and I put it off as long as possible. And then I compose at the last minute in an emergency condition, and that seems to be what works for me, although it's stressful, but it seems to be what gets the job done.
So you're one of those people who works better under pressure. I would never think that.
Apparently I work only under pressure.
Otherwise, you become quite lazy and don't hear the music. Now, I want to listen to a bit from your piece, Second Concerto for Orchestra. Tell us a little about it and who's performing it on this.
Well, this is a piece that was written for the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and which is my orchestra, so to speak, in quotation marks, and premiered by them in March of 2004. And the performance that I brought with me is by a student orchestra, believe it or not, but you won't believe how good these kids are. It's the Tanglewood Music Center Orchestra from, you know, the Berkshire Music Festival, Berkshire Music Center, in the summer of, I think, 2005. And what we have is the last 2 minutes of the finale. This is the big, flashy finish.
Let's listen. Now, this was the piece that you won the Pulitzer Prize for. Were you surprised?
I was astonished. I was very, very surprised. This would have been, I guess, April 2005. The way the Pulitzer works is that pieces which were premiered in the last something like 13 or 14 months before the prize is announced are eligible.
Mm.
And if you're a working composer, as I am, you have a publisher or other sponsors who probably nominate something of yours every year for the Pulitzer. So to be in the running is not an honor. It's a routine.
Mm-hmm.
And also routine is to wait for the first Monday in April every year and then lose, you know. And you get very used to this and you think, well, I mean, this is really not for me, you know, and you enjoy watching your friends win. Well, that 2005, I had completely forgotten about this, and I got a call. I was in my office at Cornell, actually teaching a student. I got a call from the publicity director in Los Angeles saying, I want to give you a phone number, and I want you to call the AP. And I said, well, okay, you know, and I wrote the phone number down, and I said, can this wait till tomorrow? And he said, "You actually don't know what just happened, do you?" I was apparently one of the last people to hear about it on that April Monday, because I was busy teaching. I wasn't listening to the radio or answering the phone.
So you were told by a publicity guy. Well, what was your first thought?
Well, I was really astonished. I mean, it's very gratifying. You don't, I think, when you win a prize like this, think that you wrote the best piece that year. You're just happy that you wrote something in the top 50 so that it got looked at, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then it's kind of, you know, there's a fair amount of chance because the jury changes every year.
Oh, is that so?
Tastes of the jury change every year. I will at some point be on this jury because they always make you do that once you've won. That's where they get some of their jurors. And so then I'll know what the process is like from the inside. But I've been on enough panels and juries that I know that I don't mean that these things are political. I mean that these things are human. And that, you know, there's horse trading and there are different tastes. And you know, if you come out in the top 10 or 20, you should pat yourself on the back.
That's quite astonishing. Now, I want to ask you this. How important is the performance aspect for a composer?
Well, eventually it's everything because, you know, while I'm sitting in my little room making pencil marks, I am in some ways entertaining and exciting myself with these ideas. But basically that's not good enough. You want to try them out on other people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you want that satisfaction of sharing that experience with other people, even of being in an audience, you know, and listening together. And I always find that when a new piece is played, I have to develop my own relationship with that piece as a listener, which is different than the relationship I had while I was building it.
Uh-huh.
I could imagine that a film director goes to see his movie, if he can stand it, you know, a couple of years later, and then watches it as an audience member, not as the person who made it, and sees in it different things than he thought he put in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the case with me.
Mm-hmm. And so you're sitting in your room and you're making these notations and you're creating this piece, and once it's played by a full orchestra, do you make great changes, or has it come out complete?
It has usually come out the best I can do, which is not to say that I'm not always dissatisfied with something, but it's difficult to make even small changes without affecting something else. I think of these pieces as sweaters, and I'm afraid to pull on the sleeve because it just might fall off, you know, if I start to,
uh-huh.
if it might unravel. So basically I'm kind of stuck with the piece, and I just try and do better next time.
Now you're also a conductor.
I do conduct. I've been studying. I studied conducting when I was a high school and college student. I used to conduct the high school orchestra and the college orchestra and so on. I'm not a gifted conductor. I'm just a kind of competent one. But I've always tried to keep it up because it's the only way I have of getting on stage any longer. I don't any longer play my instrument, which used to be the viola. And it seems to me important to be a working musician, and not to remove oneself into a sort of managerial, you know, class, mm-hmm. white-collar work.
And you have to be a leader.
But to be down there, you know, in the trenches with the women and men who are doing this, and it, I think, changes the way you compose. I think it makes you more realistic, more humane, more of a colleague.
Hmm. Now, you were appointed in 1988 by Andre Previn to be a composer for the Los Angeles Philharmonic. How did that come about?
Well, it's not a secret among musicians that Andre Previn is one of the most gifted and one of the laziest musicians on the face of the earth.
Is that so?
He was running the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and he managed to choose and play only one piece by a living American composer in the 1987-88 season, and it happened to be my piece called Dream Waltzes, which probably was on the top of some pile and was the only one he picked up. And when the position came open then, later in the season, they said, who would you like, what American composer would you like to invite? And he could only think of one because...
Are you serious?
I am somewhat serious. I mean, he respected my music. He thought I was the right sort of composer for orchestras and for that orchestra. And I think it's turned out well. But there was not an exhaustive search, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got there and he resigned. He jumped and was pushed during my first season. So, and we very shortly hired the Finnish conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, who's become my closest friend in music and my closest colleague. And the reason I've stayed in this job, flying back and forth, you know, wearing a groove across Kansas, I say, for 20 years is that it's so satisfying to work with the orchestra with that leadership.
Mm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Steve Stuckey. Now, speaking of Dream Waltzes, I want to play an excerpt from that. Can you tell us a little about this?
Yeah, Dream Waltzes is an old piece. I was on the way here today, I was thinking it's 1986. The piece is old enough to vote.
Let's hope it does.
It's very shocking to me. But this is a piece which is a kind of confrontation between modern sensibilities and modern ways of composing and the dream of going back to the past and living, you know, in friendlier, more romantic musical times. So what we'll hear is a kind of what sounds like a kind of disorganization or chaos or organized chaos, very distinctly modern music, which gradually sort of zeroes in on the orchestra beginning to waltz and gradually sort of sliding back into the 19th century. Then it'll be very clear, I think, that the experiment explodes in our faces. It can't quite work. We can't actually go back.
And who is playing this?
This is the Singapore Symphony on a recording on BIS Records.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen. Now, you're known as a mentor for young composers. Has the world of classical music changed a lot since you were coming up as a young composer yourself?
It has, I think, changed almost completely. My students have very different experiences, very different expectations of the profession, very different ambitions for themselves than I did. I led a quite blinded, you know, existence. I knew classical music and essentially nothing else. I didn't know much about folk music, about world music, about jazz, about rock and roll, about pop. These kids were raised on all this stuff. It's natural for them to think that they have the entire musical world at their disposal, not just the little slice that I had. Mm. Secondly, they know all about computers and electronics. I mean, it's just in their blood. And it's natural for them to be working with advanced technology. I work with a pencil, and many of them work with a computer. And you know, they all understand the modern economy of the arts, which is basically virtual.
Yeah.
So that most of them have websites, most of them can deliver their music as downloads to people without going through a publisher, without going through a record company. Mm-hmm. I sort of stand back and watch in awe what these kids understand about the world. And one of the reasons that teaching them has remained so rewarding is that I always learn as much from them as they do from me.
But do you think all of this distraction and all of this access to technology and other musical associations ruins their focus in some ways in regard to classical? Has that happened?
Well, I don't know if any particular focus is necessary. I mean, for, you know, some of the most interesting younger American composers, and younger these days means 58 and below. That standard,
right?
Change a little bit every year, are very much steeped in popular culture. It doesn't mean that they don't have good classical training or classical training. I mean, there's nothing particularly good about classical training as compared to other training. But I think that a big slice of the so-called classical music world now is not exactly classical, and I'm not sure that label is meaningful anymore. It got to be kind of the label that you looked for in Tower Records, and then, of course, Tower Records doesn't exist, so What has happened, I think, is that having such easy access to technology, for example, having a computer play back to you some very bad version of an orchestral score that you're entering, does, I think, retard young composers' technique some, because there are things that they don't have to use their ears and their brains for quite as aggressively as we did when we had nothing else. And so, for example, writing for complex forces like the orchestra is, I think, more difficult for composers because they've learned to rely on the computer to tell them what it sounds like, and the computer's wrong, usually. So I spend a lot of my time getting them away from the keyboard, from the computer keyboard.
Oh, so sometimes high tech is not the best thing.
Your brain is, you still need your brain. And your ear.
Now, do you look for not just technical skills, but that kind of what you might call poetry in somebody that you see is really going to be a talented composer?
Yeah, in fact, poetry is the main thing. What technique is for is to make the poetry come through. Technique isn't worth anything in itself, but we can all have great visions, and if we don't have the means to translate them, then nobody else will get it. Yeah, we are looking for some spark, for some personality, and it's difficult in young people because our personalities as young artists are very often just a kind of melange of all of our influences. That was certainly true of me. It's still an important factor in my makeup that I'm constantly thinking about and even kind of channeling composers that I love very much, present and past, and engaging in a kind of conversation with all of that other music outside me. So I'm not against that at all. But somehow your personality, I think, tends to be the filter that you apply to all that music that you love. And then somehow that's you.
Now, do you have any kind of a theory about why so many people are still intimidated by classical music?
Well, you know, it used to be a kind of medicine that you had to take, you know, in schools or, for that matter, in the public media. You know, you remember when television and radio in this country would broadcast symphony concerts.
I do.
And people would sort of take them, whether they wanted to or not. They sort of thought they were supposed to. And I think that when we stopped getting delivered classical music as medicine, a big impulse in the culture was to say, well, thank goodness, you know, we won. Our democratic tastes, you know, have won out over this elitist stuff. So I think the notion that there's something elitist about classical music, which is basically wrong. I mean, you know, all you have to do is listen to it and make what you want to out of it. There are no right answers, wrong answers when you're listening. I think that that notion is still around somehow, and people are somehow happy to react against it.
But you work a lot in Europe, especially in Italy. According to your biography, do you find a difference in Europe in regard to classical music?
Audiences in Italy are just about as bad as everywhere else now.
What do you mean by bad?
Well, I mean,
at least they're interested.
Small and not so interested anymore. I think the opera audience accepted, but the opera audiences were always an exception. They're an exception in this country. Opera is a kind of high-class circus, you know. I mean, what's not to like, really?
Fascinating, I know.
And you get to look, too. Where I've been very impressed still with audiences is in Germany.
Really?
The audiences in Germany are, it's still basically the old audience. You know, a family will show up, and both parents are coming with a lot of background, and they've got their three kids with them, each of whom plays an instrument, you know. It's still somehow part of the social fabric of a certain social class and certain economic class, I suppose. And it's more visible in Germany, and I get the most fantastic responses. But I was also recently in London and Paris and Barcelona and Lisbon with a new piece for the LA Phil. A piece which I would not have expected European audiences to respect very much. I might have thought that it seemed a little soft and, you know, American and easy. But in fact, people were stamping their feet and, you know, doing the rhythmic clapping in France and everything for an American orchestra playing modern music and also playing Sibelius, who is not supposed to be there, one of their composers. And so, you know, there are some very sophisticated audiences still in this country, but also in Europe.
Now, we keep hearing that classical music is in its twilight. No one really wants to buy it. What do you think about that?
I've been hearing that my whole life, too. And fortunately, this twilight is quite slow because apparently I'm going to survive to the end of my career without the death of classical music. Orchestras were supposed to go out of business also. They're so expensive. They're so, they have been so oriented towards upper middle class and white audiences and urban audiences. Orchestras have been working very hard to broaden their base, and with some success. And we've had great success in Los Angeles. A lot of factors coming together, but somehow, when you hear this music, for many of us, it's still so urgent, and it goes straight into some place where we live, that you can't imagine human beings doing without it, even if it's a small demographic.
Mm.
So. We may have a small slice of the pie, but we're still in the pie, and I think it's probably going to stay that way.
I hope so. I think classical music still comes from the angels. Now, we only have about a minute left. What are you working on?
Well, I'm not allowed to tell you, but I will sort of talk around the problem. I'm writing a piece for an orchestra in the southwest of this country, and it's not Fort Worth, and it's not San Antonio, and it's not Austin, and it's not Houston. But they haven't announced this project yet. And it's a large oratorio-like piece, chorus, orchestra, and soloists, for the fall of 2008, on a political topic. I wish I could say more, but I'll call you in February, and as soon as the Dallas Symphony has announced this project, and let you know the details.
Oh, that's great. Well, Steve Stuckey, thank you so much for joining us. We have run out of time, and we hope to hear you throughout the years.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.